Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio is on pace for a record number of executions this year, and a controversial case is pending before the parole board, which has the power to recommend to the governor to spare a man's life in light of serious concerns about his guilt or innocence. And, oh yes, it's an election year as well. So how does the death penalty in Ohio play into politics? Coming up later, we're going to talk to Ohio Supreme Court Justice Paul Pfeiffer. He's calling for a comprehensive review of all death row cases and perhaps a moratorium on executions during that review. And we'll also welcome former longtime Ohio Prisons Director Reggie Wilkinson, who wants the review as well, the moratorium as well, but also is calling for an end to the death penalty in Ohio. Right now, we welcome back Andrew Welsh Huggins. Andrew covers legal affairs, including capital punishment, for the Associated Press in Columbus. He is the author of No Winners Here Tonight, A History of the Death Penalty in Ohio, and the upcoming Hatred at Home, the story of three domestic terrorists based in Columbus. Welcome back, Andrew.
Thank you.
How are you doing?
Doing well.
Is it unusual in Ohio for the likes of Justice Paul Pfeiffer to call for a moratorium and review of the death penalty?
I think what's unusual is people will remember that Pfeiffer was one of the key authors of the current law. So back in the late 70s and early 80s, he was the one, along with a couple other Republican lawmakers, who were sounding the horn for a new death penalty law. So the fact that he's out there saying we should review the very law he helped create, I think, is a little bit unusual. He's been quietly pushing for this kind of review for some time, meaning in the past 7 or 8 years. I think once he got on the Supreme Court and he started to see, the results of the law he created, he's had a lot of questions about it. So it is unusual, I think, both for a former lawmaker and, of course, a Supreme Court justice to be making this argument.
And it's also a political issue, and usually justices don't talk about these kinds of things, do they?
No, they don't, and they're happy not to. Once they get on the court, it gives them this this blanket of anonymity in a way on these kind of public issues. He, for a long time, has said that he was not convinced prosecutors were using the law the way it was meant for. He said all along what we wanted was a law for the worst of the worst, the absolute worst criminals to face the death sentence. He has said that with that, he won't comment on any specific cases, but he has said that he's been concerned that there's too many kind of domestic violence cases that turn deadly, that those have been turned into death penalty cases. And that's been one of his concerns, that the law was not meant for those sort of crimes of passion that turn deadly. It was meant for the calculated killers.
The worst of the worst, though, no matter what, it's still a subjective term.
It is, and that's one of the issues around the death penalty. Now, you could take the, Massachusetts attempted to deal with this by saying it's got to be multiple victims, there has to be eyewitnesses and DNA. But, again, is the worst person someone who kills three children? Is the worst person someone who kills an innocent bank teller during a bank robbery? So it is. Everything about the death penalty is subjective.
How different is it now in terms of how it is how justice is carried out in terms of the death penalty than, say, it was before the death penalty was banned in the United States for a period of time before
Yeah, that's a great question. The whole reason the U.S. Supreme Court ended the death penalty in 1972 was they felt it was just absolutely too arbitrary that, you had 16,000 murders in the United States, you might have 50 death sentences, and there was absolutely no rationale for why some people got the death sentence and other people didn't. Now, the goal after 76, when they reinstated the death penalty, the goal was to sort of end that irrationality and come up with specific criteria. And I think states had mixed success with it. If you look at a lot of the cases from Ohio in the 1980s, early 1990s, I think it's very easy to find that same issue. Why did X number of people end up on death row for crimes that were extremely similar, committed by people who didn't end up on death row? So, in my study of the issue, I think states have had very mixed success. There is still, it's a roll of the dice, still, depending on where you are, the jury you get, the prosecutor in charge of your case, whether you get the death penalty for a crime that one county over might just land you in prison for life.
My guest is Andrew Welsh Huggins, Associated Press reporter and also author of No Winners Here Tonight, Race, Politics, and Geography in One of the Country's Busiest Death Penalty States. Do you think very many Ohioans think of themselves as being residents of one of the busiest death penalty states, Andrew?
I don't think they do, and this often surprises people when I tell them that. I think, first of all, we're seeing about an execution a month right now, and that really takes people by surprise. We're second to Texas, which, of course, is the leading execution state. Texas still puts to death between 20 and 25 people a year. But Ohio, which of course, we consider ourselves, you know, a northern state, considers ourselves a sort of moderate state. Ohio's second behind Texas. We've put 7 people to death this year. That's tied the record for Ohio, tied the record since 81.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to believe, even with this case that you spoke about coming up, whether
Kevin Keith.
Now, regardless of whether that execution goes off, there's at least 2 more scheduled this year, so I'm sure we probably will break the record.
Now, some states have banned the death penalty for a really long time. Michigan, for example, since the mid-1800s.
That's right. Rhode Island is another example.
What do we know about the differences between states in that case? I mean, Michigan's just over the line. Besides the obvious football rivalry, we have a lot more in common than we do different from Michigan.
Yeah, and Wisconsin is the same way. These mm-hmm. are more similar states. I would say probably the key difference and the thing people always point to with Ohio is, for a state our size, we do have this is kind of an obvious point, but we have mm-hmm. a lot of cities.
Right.
We have the big three, obviously, but then we also have lots and lots of medium-sized cities. We have, you know, Mansfield and Warren and Marion, Springfield, just lots and lots of cities, and, you know, cities produce crime. And okay. So I think we probably have a higher proportion of crime that has led for calls to the death penalty that other states don't have.
What is happening now in the Kevin Keith case? The parole board is considering the motion now.
That's right. Kevin Keith is a what they call a pure innocence claim, and we have really not had a case like this this prominently in Ohio. He was convicted and sentenced to die for just a brutal killing in Bucyrus in 1994. Somebody walked into an apartment. There were several people there. He ordered everybody on the floor. 3 people were killed, including a very young girl. 3 other people were wounded and left to die, including a 4 and 7-year-old brother and sister. He says he has alibi witnesses that place him elsewhere. His defense attorneys have identified an alternate suspect. And they produce evidence saying that someone told them that this person had boasted that he would. This all involved the allegation here is that there was a drug bust in Bucyrus and there was a snitch involved. And so the allegation is that this murder was retribution against family members of the drug informant.
Mm-hmm.
So there's evidence that this alternate suspect boasted that he would. He was going to be paid to take care of the people who were involved in this in the drug informant situation. The parole board held a 13-hour hearing on this issue last week, which is probably close to a record, if not the longest hearing they've ever held on a death penalty case. And you know, this is a classic situation where the defense has reams and reams of evidence which they believe show that Keith did not do it. The prosecution says they come back and they tackle each one and they say we're confident the correct man was convicted and we think he should be executed next month. So the board, he's asked for clemency, and people sometimes forget clemency is more than just did he do it or not. Clemency is mercy. And so Traditionally, clemency is available for a governor to look at a case and say, for a variety of reasons, could be the defendant's remorse, could be problems with the case, could be discrepancy in how other people involved were sentenced. The governor can say, okay, I agree to show mercy. In modern times, it's become much more political, and it does mm-hmm. tend to come down to innocence and facts of the case.
The last time I remember a big batch of clemencies being granted was after the notion of the battered woman syndrome became accepted.
That's right. Former Governor Celeste commuted the sentences of eight inmates, four of them women, six of them black, if I have this correct. Mm-hmm. And the battered woman syndrome was a big issue, but Celeste was also concerned about issues of race. He was very mm-hmm. concerned about the number of African Americans on death row. And he looked at some of these cases and was concerned that, these were sort of, instead of the worst of the worst, the lowest of the low, the mental illnesses, lives of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought about emptying Ohio's death row at the time and just decided that the political chaos that would create would be too big. So he did these eight, and that's, in Ohio, clearly still the biggest example we've had of this.
Kevin, Keith has a few things in common with most death row inmates and with really most prison inmates in general in Ohio. He's low income and he's African American.
That's right.
Big problem for a lot of people in the way the sentence has been meted out that way.
Yeah, there certainly are the proportion of African Americans on death row is higher than the numbers in the general population.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's probably a lot closer. It's probably consistent. I mean, the fact is, there are more African Americans in prison than white people, regardless of how bad the sentence is. I mean, that's just a sociological fact.
Right.
The numbers aren't that much greater for death row.
Yeah.
What I found for Ohio, and what many, many people have found, is actually the far bigger issue is that if a victim's race is white, if you kill a white person, you're far more likely to end up on death row than you are if the victim is black. So the twist in this case, of course, is yes, Kevin Keith is black. The alternate suspect is black, but all his victims were black as well.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, I think it was one of these crimes that clearly just shocked the community. So a lot of people have focused on Kevin Keith's race, but I don't think that is that significant in this case. I think the real issue is, there were questions about how witnesses first identified him, and there were lots of allegations that police sort of settled on Kevin Keith as a suspect, strongly hinted to survivors that this was the guy, and that over time, just this sort of narrative has stuck that, well, Kevin Keith is the one who did it, and he's the one that should be put to death. And that's the argument that his attorneys are pushing hard against, that you need to look beyond sort of what the standard story is in this case.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break. My guest is Andrew Welsh Huggins, Associated Press reporter and also author of No Winners Here Tonight, Race, Politics, and Geography in One of the Country's Busiest Death Penalty States. Joining us in a few minutes, Ohio Supreme Court Justice Paul Pfeiffer and also Dr. Reginald Wilkinson. He is a CEO and president of Ohio College Access Network now, but for many years he was chief of the Ohio prison system. We will be right back with All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is Neil Conan. Here on Talk of the Nation, we learn a lot about our guests, like journalist Bob Woodward, who noticed that we really like to listen to our callers.
You do these calls, you put the caller on, and leave them on.
Even Woodward's been shuffled off other programs.
Anyone been a dumped caller?
Have your say and a follow-up on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation will be here this afternoon at 2 o'clock, right here on the WSU 820 NPR News. And a beautiful day in central Ohio today, currently 75 degrees at 1021. Sunshine today and a high of 85 and not quite as humid as the past few days. Clear skies tonight and a low right around 60. Sunshine for Tuesday and a high of 85. And looking ahead to Wednesday, more sunshine and a high of 87. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher, talking about the death penalty in Ohio. Should it be reviewed? Should it end? Joining us now is Ohio Supreme Court Justice Paul Pfeiffer. He has served in both houses of the Ohio General Assembly, including four terms in the Ohio Senate. That's where I caught up with him, and where he served as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee for 10 years. Welcome to the show, Justice Pfeiffer.
Good to be with you, Ann.
Also joining us today is former Ohio Prisons Chief Reggie Wilkinson. Reggie is now president and CEO of the Ohio College Access Network. He was appointed prisons director in 1991 and reappointed in 1999. He left the job in 2006. He has been with the department, or he had been with the department since 1973 and served as a warden, supervisor of training, and deputy director before taking on the job, taking the top job there. So during his tenure, Reggie Wilkinson supervised 20 executions in the state of Ohio. A lot of experiences to share. Welcome to the show, Reggie.
Thank you.
I guess we were talking earlier, Justice Pfeiffer, about how unusual it is for someone of your stature to come out like you are and call for at least a moratorium and a review, if not an outright abolishment of the death penalty. What inspired you at this point to do this?
Well, I've been talking particularly with Andrew, who has delved into this subject at length. Over a period of time, I guess, first of all, I never dreamed when I was involved in crafting the statute that's in place now that I would be on the court and having to review these cases. And this process, it's the change that has occurred, the drift that's occurred over time, in my opinion, where the application of the death penalty has been expanded in subtle and perhaps not such subtle ways. For example, we have the felony murder provision. If you kill someone in the commission of a robbery, for example, kill someone that you've raped, kill someone that you've kidnapped. Well, over time, prosecutors started double and triple charging these cases. So when we get the review on them, if there's a robbery or if there's a rape, there's also a charge of kidnapping on the basis that technically you held someone against their will for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, it seemed to me the court definitionally kept expanding this, and I've dissented on some of those cases. And then you add in the more critical fact that the legislature appropriately, in my view, added in death without possibility of parole. We tried to get that and had that in the Senate version of the original bill back in 1981.
Right.
And the House refused to go along with that. And I still remember the conference committee in which Representative Tranter argued that life in prison without possibility of parole was more cruel punishment than the death sentence. I could never figure out how to respond to that, but the House dug in, and so we didn't have it in the original bill. It's been added, and since it's been added, juries and prosecutors have not charged death if they can get a plea to life and an acceptance of life in prison without possibility of parole. And juries that are hearing these cases are opting to give life without possibility of parole in a large number of cases. I think last year we maybe only had two death sentences meted out in the whole state.
Right. You know, it is. There are fewer and fewer every year.
Right.
So I'm wondering why the call for a review then, if there's fewer and fewer. Isn't the system working?
Well, what I think should be reviewed is we've got, I don't know the number, that are still sitting there on death row. Most of those did not, the juries didn't have the option of life without possibility of parole. So they may be executed just because of the luck of the draw is in terms of the way the statute was at the time they were sentenced as opposed to now. And so what I'm suggesting is a blue ribbon panel. I think somebody like former Governor Voinovich, who had to look at these, was lucky enough never to have to deal with it, I believe, in his 8 years as governor. But someone who has sat in that chair, who has had to make those calls to head up a blue ribbon commission that looks at these and decides, is death appropriate in all of the cases for people who are sitting on death row?
Justice Pfeiffer, now that you've taken this stand publicly like you have, do you recuse yourself from death penalty cases before the court?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, there are still cases. I have not taken the step of calling for the end of the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And even if I did, I don't expect I would recuse because it is the law that applies to the cases that we're looking at the time. The court, and this is an area where I've been critical of our court and my colleagues, one of the things that we built into the statute is a requirement for an independent review and judgment as to whether or not death is appropriate. In other words, we put the Supreme Court in the same shoes as the jury.
Mm-hmm.
In the same shoes as the trial judge on that question, to look at each one and decide, you know, is this person really the worst of the worst? And even if you find that they committed the crime, and I dare say that I would be surprised to find anyone on death row who isn't the perpetrator, and that includes Kevin Keith. I've had a chance to look at that case twice. The governor may commute it because his lawyers have stirred up some doubt. I just didn't have any on that one. But there is a concept called residual doubt, and then there is also the duty on the court to weigh them independently. And I think our court has really sort of thrown their hands in the air, and they just look at these and say, well, you know, this person's just as bad as the last three. So the independent weighing has gotten short shrift. But these things keep moving. We now have the U.S. Supreme Court weighing in on you don't execute juveniles. We didn't permit that to happen in Ohio. You don't execute someone who is mentally retarded. Now, there's a bit of debate over that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think questions will continue to stir as to whether or not you should execute someone who was profoundly mentally ill but didn't meet the insanity test.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly have a lot of those.
Reggie Wilkinson, you supervised 20 executions while you were in charge of the prison system in Ohio. Did you oppose the death penalty the entire time?
I didn't oppose the death penalty at all.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until maybe 6 months after I retired from state service that I part of that was because I wasn't even sure if I was against the death penalty or not.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly made up my mind, after I witnessed and supervised 20 executions in this state and decided, once I retired that I had no other reason to suppress, what I thought I believed and concretize that belief pretty quickly.
What is it? What was the tipping point for you?
I just, it was just a series of things and studying what goes on in other industrialized nations around the world. You know, to me, I thought it was very odd that the United States was the only country in either North or South America other than Cuba and St. Kitts.
You know, I think not even Cuba anymore.
Yeah, and that maybe not even Cuba anymore. And some countries have the death penalty, but only for high crimes like terrorism and treason during war. But other than that, you know, the United States is the is certainly the only country in any of the Americas and one of the few industrialized nations in the world that have it. And I'm saying, well, how can we be, you know, that different than other intelligent, industrialized, and globally competitive nations?
Inside the prison system, how are death penalty and death row inmates viewed?
You know, they're segregated. First of all, mm-hmm. death row is a housing area in and of itself. They only interact for the most part with other persons on death row. And, you know, probably the perception is, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And most prisoners don't have an opinion because they don't come in contact with persons on death row. Even their visiting is very limited. The only persons who can have contact visit with them are attorneys. So for the most part, it's just a small unit at, you know, our prison in Youngstown, and I don't think there is a lot of perception about it whatsoever.
Andrew Welsh Huggins, there's about 150, 160 people on death row now in Ohio?
That's 160. Mm-hmm.
Is that a high point, or are they getting whittled down?
Oh, no, it's 10 years ago, we had 200 people on death row.
Yeah.
So it's falling for two reasons. One is a simple fact is we've executed 40.
Mm-hmm.
So we've simply executed a lot of death row inmates. There also have been a few where their cases have been rejected by the courts, so that they've been taken off death row. But the other reason it's smaller is something that you alluded to, is that there are simply fewer death sentences being handed out. There was one death sentence in Ohio in 2009. There's actually been five this year, so we've seen a bit of an uptick. But death sentences are going down. Death indictments are going way down. Mm-hmm. Many prosecutors have simply stopped charging people with death, and a very good example of that is right here in Franklin County, where the prosecutors essentially stopped indicting people on death penalty charges. I think there were two last year, and not very long ago, Ronald Bryan was charging, you know, 30 people a year with death penalty specs. So,
but he supports the death penalty. How much, Justice Pfeiffer, what about the politics of all of this? The governor, Ted Strickland, attorney general who has to defend these cases in court, Rich Cordray, they support the death penalty. They don't even want a review or a moratorium or anything.
Yeah, politically, I think it's probably difficult still to come out four square against the death penalty. When I say that, I'm not sure of that. When we were enacting there were a couple of people in the Senate. Mike Swartzwelder, I recall, on the Judiciary Committee, was an ardent foe of the death penalty. And I always respected that, and I don't think that he suffered any political consequence. If that's your belief, and you articulate it well, as Reggie has, and you know. My sense is the view in Ohio is changing, and I doubt if there are very many people that are comfortable with the idea that we are starting to put to death people at a clip similar to Texas. That's an honor that I suspect people really don't enjoy, or an attribute of Ohio that not many citizens are that proud of. Some are, but most are not.
In New Mexico last year, they abolished the death penalty, and a big reason for that was the cost. The state of New Mexico simply couldn't afford it anymore. In this kind of an economic downturn like we're in, that should last for several years in one way or another, particularly when the state's facing a possible $8 billion budget shortfall. Should finances come into play? Should it be part of the conversation, Reggie?
I think it does come into play. We may not ever know that, but I think just looking at the numbers, I mean, it can cost $100,000 or more to prosecute a death case. And that's a big bite out of a budget of a county government.
Yeah, that's at the trial level.
Right, that's at the trial level. Mm-hmm. And when you look at, you know, county budgets and the percentage that they already spend on courts and law enforcement and anything related to the justice system, to add the burden of costs to prosecute a death case, a capital punishment case, it can be astronomical. So I'm not even sure that I mean, I agree maybe with the House in 1981 that it isn't a worse punishment to have a person in prison for the rest of their lives. And it's debatable whether or not it's more expensive to have a person in prison for the rest of their life or to have that person continue to file appeals after appeals, what's most expensive. But I don't see it as soft on crime at all to not have the death penalty. You know, in my mind at least, it can, you know, be better for victims because they will at least know what to expect after 20 years of sitting on death row. You know, they're going to be in anxiety. They're going to be anxiety ridden for 20 years, whereby if they were sentenced to life without the possibility of parole, they'll know what the fate of that person might be.
Of course, the argument there, Reggie, as you're well aware, is that people often say, well, if the process just didn't take so long, there'd be more immediate justice, and people wouldn't have that those 2 decades of absolute anguish.
Sure. Yeah, it takes about 11 in Texas, but even 11 years is a long time.
Justice Pfeiffer, what about that finance factor? Should that enter into the discussion as a former lawmaker?
I think it does. It probably isn't stated. There used to be estimates that there was $1 million expenditure tied up until you got through all the appeals. I don't know that that's accurate. Reggie's probably right that it's more like $100,000 starting out, and then who knows what the cost of all the appeals. The state's paying, obviously, for the lawyers on both sides of it, and it certainly would weigh on the minds of legislators. Coming back to a review under the governor's clemency powers, as you pointed out, we're in tough and challenging economic times, and particularly challenging for state government budgets. And I think it makes sense for the next governor to be able to focus 100% of his time on solving those problems and solving the budget problems. We're now setting, because these cases are there are so many people on death row that have exhausted all their state and federal appeals. I think the last time we met last week, we set another 4 cases or voted to have dates set. So they're being set at the clip of 1 a month. Apparently, the present governor doesn't want to see them happen faster than 1 a month. So that's and ironically, we take time off for Christmas. And I don't know what that tells you about the general view of the death penalty. But the next governor is going to have dates set and queued up out into the foreseeable future. And if they're to take their clemency review seriously, that's going to require a lot of time. And it's time that I think the governor could be spending more productively on other things.
We have to take another break. My guests, Andrew Welch Huggins, Associated Press reporter, Paul Pfeiffer, Ohio Supreme Court Justice, and Reggie Wilkinson, former prisons chief for the state of Ohio. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Developed by WOSU Public Media and the Columbus Metropolitan Library, ColumbusNeighborhoods.org features over 30 neighborhoods in and around Columbus and allows users to tell their own stories, post their own photos and video, and contribute to the collective story of Columbus. To be a part of this multimedia public engagement project or to learn more, visit ColumbusNeighborhoods.org.
Good morning. You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides will be here, and we'll hear about a young woman's coming of age, navigating the realities of race and class in America. That discussion begins at 11. Hear more of WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher whenever you want with the online archive. Podcast new and archive shows from all the guests and topics. Podcast All Sides at WOSU.org/All Sides. And it's 76 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today and a high of 85. Clear skies tonight and a low right around 60. Sunshine for Tuesday and a high of 85. And sunshine looking ahead to Wednesday and a high of 87. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest, Dr. Reginald Wilkinson, he's president and CEO of the Ohio College Access Network, but he is here today as former prisons chief for the state of Ohio. Also, Ohio Supreme Court Justice Paul Pfeiffer and Andrew Welch Huggins of the Associated Press. Justice Pfeiffer, is there a model program out there that you would like to see Ohio emulate, perhaps, in terms of how justice is carried out in death penalty cases?
Well, I've never looked at that. There may be something different than ours. The history on our statute was it had been knocked down twice by the U.S. Supreme Court because it was too broad in its application. So at the time that we enacted it, our goal was to have a statute that was very limited in its application. And Larry Herman, who was professor of law at Ohio State, came in and testified at my invitation, arguing that we shouldn't even include felony murder in it because it was bootstrapping, was his argument to the death penalty. And he would have had us, of course, he was opposed to the death penalty altogether, but he would have had us limit it to killing police officers, prison guards, multiple killings, not have it to include felony murder, which is the thing that certainly got an awful lot of those people to death row that are there today. So I'm sure there are other states that have a death penalty that is more narrow in its application. And one of the things that I saw, and the governor just recently commuted a case, is we were trying to avoid applying the death penalty in essentially domestic squabbles that escalate to the point that there's a murder. Now, all of those are tragic, but those are very common in our society. And that's, again, an example of how this thing got pushed to the point that death was being meted out in cases that we certainly didn't intend when we enacted the statute. And for example, this case the governor recently commuted, this guy and his girlfriend are getting all loaded at a bar. They go home. They get in a quarrel. He kills her, strangles her, I think, if forget exactly what. I mean, it wasn't grotesque. He killed her. And after he killed her, he took her car keys, drove back to the bar and drank some more. And the taking of her car keys was used to qualify him for felony murder. Well, he didn't kill her because he wanted her car. He killed her because they got angry with each other over something. Clearly, and I dissented on that, clearly something that the statute wasn't meant to apply to. But our court blessed that. And that's just one example of how the statute got expanded into areas that were certainly never intended. And that's watching these occur over time is what has led me to the view that people who weren't involved in the prosecution of these, people of stature, could serve a governor very well by reviewing them all. If they're ones that are just inappropriate, get them off death row and end the appeals.
There's a, Andrew, I have a,
yeah, sure, Andrew.
Justice, there's been a suggestion that Ohio move to the federal model, that we take the decision to charge away from county prosecutors. We create a statewide, you know, death penalty board of some kind. And any time there's a case that might fit the criteria, a statewide board looks at it and makes the decision. The argument there is that that would take the politics out of it. You would be sticking to the law. Of course, the counter argument is it would be another blow to local control. Would you support a statewide approach to capital punishment?
It seems to me that would be a very sensible thing for the General Assembly to review. Now, local prosecutors, at least some of them might oppose that. Some of them would probably welcome it.
Yeah.
Because it's just a very tough thing. Another example of where this becomes difficult and doesn't involve death. I was just reading an article recently about a woman who's about to be charged for vehicular homicide. Now she got way too consumed way too much alcohol, but she was in a one car accident that killed two of her children. When I was prosecuting, I was an assistant prosecutor. My law partner was the prosecutor. His view on cases like that was punishment enough. That this woman is going to have to live the rest of her life with the knowledge that her irresponsibility caused the death of her two children. Other places, prosecutors are sending people like that to prison for a long period of time. So it is these things can be very uneven in their application. And coming back to money, in the smaller counties, driven in part by the funding issue. So,
yeah, I was going to ask you, Andrew, as far as that proposal goes for a statewide death penalty board, would state money follow that? Because the board could just issue death penalty cases without regard to cost.
Well, that's a good point, and I should say I'm not aware of any proposal on the table for this. It's been suggested, but you're right. I suppose it could have if you had a very small county, which had a pretty heinous case, and they came back and said we're going to charge this as a death penalty case, then the county stuck. But again, I suppose in that situation there ought to be a state funding mechanism that if a state panel was going to recommend capital charges or authorize them, then the state ought to be picking up the tab on the, there's all these investigators that both sides need to hire and should hire, and the experts. And so, talking off the top of my head, I think if the state had such a entity, the state ought to pay for it.
Reggie Wilkinson, when we're talking about life without chance of parole and death row, are the costs to house those kinds of inmates basically the same, or does that segregation of death row inmates create costs that aren't the case for with life without parole?
It's more expensive to house a person on death row than it is persons who are in prison for life without parole. It's just the intensity and the risk level and the, you know, security all dictate that there is more staff per person on death row than anywhere else in the system. So it's going to cost, you know, I'm not sure exactly how much more, but it's demonstrable in terms of the cost to house a person on death row as opposed to anywhere else inside any of our correctional institutions.
Andrew, in addition to saying that he just doesn't think it's necessarily necessary, the governor said he's concerned about setting up an extrajudicial process by way of a review of the death penalty cases in Ohio. What's the problem with an extrajudicial process?
Yeah, that's an interesting comment. I mean, plenty of states have had these commissions, Maryland,
Illinois.
Illinois, mm-hmm. They frankly probably had, especially Illinois, has had far more problems with their death row than Ohio has. I think you're talking about two different things, and I suppose one issue would be, is this panel going to look at individual cases and make rulings on individual cases, or is it going to examine them overall?
Mm-hmm.
I should also remind people that Shirley Smith, the Cleveland lawmaker, proposed this sort of moratorium, or at least a study bill of the death penalty at least four times by my count when she was in the House. And one time the House did pass and agree to do a death penalty study bill, and that proposal lasted exactly 24 hours until it hit the Senate, and then it was immediately rejected. So it's been tried, and it's a tough sell. If you're just going to do a study, I don't see how that's an extrajudicial review, I suppose, as long as it doesn't get into looking at every single case and every single detail.
Do you have to have, Justice Pfeiffer, a moratorium along with the review, or are they mutually inclusive?
Well, I have not called for a moratorium. I mm-hmm. wouldn't be opposed to a moratorium.
Okay.
But what I have called for, and will whoever is elected governor, I will formalize it in the form of a letter outlining the reasons I think it would be beneficial, is strictly the exercise of the governor's power. So to the extent Governor Strickland is saying this is extrajudicial, or my colleagues didn't want to comment on this, saying, well, it could raise issues they'd be asked to rule on, that's not what I'm contemplating. The constitutional power to commute sentences rests strictly with the governor.
Mm-hmm.
And what I am suggesting is that the governor pick the panel, and the view is an honest review of the cases that are staying there on death row. And if they want to make some legislative changes, recommendations for legislative changes, that's fine. But really what I envision is something that gives the governor political cover to do a mass commutation of all of those that the committee says these people really shouldn't be subject to the death penalty. Then the governor looks at those and says, I think it's a fine report. I'm just going to commute them all right now, and do that at the front of your term instead of waiting, as Governor Celeste did, on the way out the door. I think it's a far more honest way to do it. If it's done early on, whatever blowback, if any, there is from the public, and I'm not sure there would be, that's such an old issue by the time the next governor's race goes off that I don't see it as a big political downside. But I'm really talking about something the governor creates
mm-hmm.
as a part of his constitutional power to commute. So I don't see any legal issues involved in that at all. And I'm not sure once this election's over that the next governor, even though both candidates have said, well, they don't think much of the idea, that they might not think again about that when they see that every month in their new term as governor, they're going to be facing another one of these death cases.
When you're thinking about this review committee, what sorts of people are you thinking about serving on it? Would you think the governor would appoint? Is it people, you know, obviously lawyers and prosecutors and that kind of a thing, and judges probably, but people like, I don't know, Reggie Wilkinson, former prisons director?
Yeah, I think a cross-section of people, and it probably should include people who have concluded we shouldn't have a death penalty at all, and people who are put Dick Finan on it. He was the
former Senate President Dick Finan,
who he was the lead sponsor of the bill, and I was the scrivener, or with the help of the LSC, trying to get all of these things in place that I thought would pass constitutional muster, and they have. I co-sponsored it with Dick, but he was the lead sponsor, and he loved to go give the speeches, the pounding on the table about why we needed this. So, yeah, you can have some table pounding person who thinks it's just the greatest thing to have this, but it ought to be a cross section. But that's the governor's call, and he can name anybody he wants to. But I think people of stature and people with experience, like Reggie's experience, and that's also why I thought Governor Voinovich, who has had to sit there and stare at these, I think in his case, praying that he wasn't going to have to face the decision. You know, Governor Rhodes was governor for 16 years, and Andrew can tell us, I forget, but there was like one or two executions, and they mysteriously just stopped while Rhodes was governor.
We're running out of time. Justice Paul Pfeiffer of the Ohio Supreme Court, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Also, Dr. Reginald Wilkinson, President and CEO of Ohio College Access Network, but also former prisons director for many, many years. Thanks for joining us, Reggie.
Thank you, Ann.
And Andrew Welsh Huggins, AP reporter and author of No Winners Here. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank
you. That's all the time we have for All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.